This download is made possible by all the generous folks who support public radio. If that includes you, thank you. If not, become a contributing member to your local station. And now, here's the show. It's The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. On a Friday where things have really settled down around the nation news-wise, and I think that's a very good thing, although our hearts go out to all of our West Coast friends cleaning up from that dreadful storm in Northern California, TGIF for all of you out there, we will range our conversation from the Hollywood Bible and the question, which is worse, simulating a plague of frogs on screen or angering some people by casting all the good guys as whites and all the bad guys as blacks? That's something director Ridley Scott is dealing with this week. We'll do some calendar math, 12, 13, 14, coming up, and take a hard look at homelessness in Massachusetts. But we begin with an inside look at the ISIS organization from the perspective of someone who is now one of its senior leaders. For years, Martin Chuloff and his team at The Guardian worked a source to get permission to speak to a jihadist called Abu Ahmed about the story of ISIS, the history, its aspirations, its inner workings. The results are remarkable and have been published in The Guardian. And journalist Martin Chuloff joins us now from Beirut. Martin, welcome to The Takeaway.
Good to be with you.
Now, can you describe the circumstances under which you first met Abu Ahmed and how you've sort of negotiated this interview that really gives us an insight into the interior of ISIS?
Well, I first met this gentleman just on 2 years ago, a bit longer than 2 years, actually. I'd known at the time that he was a former member of Al-Qaeda in Iraq. He was in a room. We were having a feast on the floor in southern Turkey. It was clear to me that he was interested in talking. Really only this year that that rapport that we were slowly building came to fruition, and he was prepared to sit down and speak ever more disarmingly, more candidly, about what he'd done in the past and about what he was doing now.
And he is someone who has worked very closely with Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, yes?
He certainly knew him in the early days. He certainly spent time in prison with him, knows his character, and is somebody who's familiar with his circle now. It's difficult to go into that, but the man most definitely is connected and is still involved in the insurgency in Iraq.
If it was only that he was connected because they both went to the same prison, that would be revelation enough, in that they both were held at Camp Buka prison in Iraq when the U.S. was in control of that prison. Isn't that correct?
Yeah, and he gives some intriguing insights into those early days. That's going back 10 years now, in which Abu Bakr, even back then, was a figure that was clearly going somewhere. They knew, according to Abu Ahmed, within the prison that he was a born leader, that he was looking to perhaps conquer and divide in order to assert his authority. He'd established to them from very early on that he had a direct lineage back to the Prophet Muhammad, and also had a PhD from an Islamic university in Baghdad. They knew that this was a formidable figure. That said, though, they didn't realize that a decade on, he would emerge as such a truly historic figure.
How did he characterize Camp Buka as a, an institution which on some level got people together who've rejoined as ISIS?
He said it was essential to getting ISIS organized. Him and many others like him were rounded up from the streets of Anbar province and in Baghdad and taken down to a giant clearinghouse in the southern deserts of Iraq. He said there were many jihadists, many committed ideologues amongst them, but there were others who weren't. They were simply rounded up in sweeps, and they became radicalized because of the resentment that they felt towards the Americans. So he said that the opportunity was something that they couldn't have bought. Here they were alongside most of the entire Al-Qaeda leadership, and they were able to network, to coordinate, and to plot for when they eventually got out.
And did he characterize what Buka was, other than a prison?
To him, it was a university of jihad, of terror, that he learned more in prison than he did out in the streets. That said, he didn't have any issues with the treatment towards him or others. It was clinical. It was calm. They were fed. They were housed. But the issue was that him and many others like him believe they shouldn't be there. They were rounded up from the streets of their own country, sent to a prison by an occupying power, and they deeply resented it.
Did the U.S. army and the people controlling the prison have any sense of who Abu Ahmed was or Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi were?
Abu Ahmed was a bit more than a foot soldier in those days, but nonetheless, he wasn't particularly important strategically. Abu Bakr, it's fair to say, had not began his meteoric rise to leading the world's most formidable terror organization, but the Americans clearly identified him as somebody who could play a conciliatory role within the prison. He had cast himself as an arbiter during disputes, and he seemed to get along very well with his jailers, according to Abu Ahmed, and the Americans let him out after 9 months, believing that he posed no further risk.
And how would you describe Abu Ahmed in terms of his role in ISIS right now?
He's a senior figure. He's very, very connected. There is no doubt that he is trusted by his subordinates and by his superiors. That said, he doesn't want to be there anymore. 10 years ago, it was more or less fun for young firebrands shooting at American tanks in Fallujah. When you get a bit older, and you've got a family, you've got established ties, and you start to see things through the world through a different lens, as Abu Ahmed has, then it's no longer the attractive choice that it was as a youngster. But he feels as though that he could go nowhere if he were to run. It would be an incredible threat to both him and his family, so he does feel trapped by his circumstances.
And he criticizes ISIS for its violence. Does he believe that ISIS will be successful in a purely jihadist way?
He does. He thinks that the momentum that the organization has now is almost unstoppable. He doesn't believe that the Americans have the stomach to come back to Iraq and to fight them on the ground. He said that would be necessary. He does believe that the Sunni street is restive and disempowered, and that ISIS is providing a vehicle for their political ambitions, and that accounts for their popular support. It must be remembered that there are only a small number of hardline ideologues who truly buy into the worldview. There are many others who have gone along for the ride, either out of coercion, fear, or believing that this organization and no other political body can actually represent their interests.
And this is what comes out of your piece. This is the key innovation that Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi has brought to ISIS, in that he's able to manage both the hardcore jihadists and the people who are along for the ride and kind of leverage the power of both of those. Is that a fair characterization?
It is, and he's done so on the ruins of a totally failed body politic right across the Levant, and that is Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon, where over more than a decade now, the Sunnis of this part of the world, and they are a majority, do believe that they have been disenfranchised, first of all by the invasion of Iraq, which ousted Saddam and empowered the Iranians inadvertently, then by the assassination of Rafiq Hariri in Lebanon, who was a Sunni patron of the Levant. Hezbollah run Lebanon now, and that's beyond dispute. And then thirdly, by the Syrian revolution, where a majority Sunni uprising has been beaten back by the Alawites, who are linked to Iran, and with very strong Iranian support. And the Sunni opposition there believes it has had no support from the West, or minimal support. And this is all bleeding into one now. The borders are increasingly irrelevant.
Finally, what is the chance that this Abu Ahmed fellow is just feeding you a line, that basically he serves some sort of propaganda purposes, and they're using you, and the best evidence for that might be that, he'll be executed for talking to you and criticizing ISIS. How can you believe him?
We've taken great pains to fact check this in a number of ways, which I really can't disclose. But it has been an exhaustive process, not just by myself, but senior members of the organization. We've checked in Baghdad, we've checked in Syria, we've checked elsewhere. We know his provenance, we know where he's from, we know that he is real, and he's produced untold things that I'm not at liberty to report, which have reinforced his bona fides.
Do you fear for his safety as a result of this publication?
Thought about that a lot since it's been published, and I believe that there was nothing in that piece which is going to lead ISIS towards him, because they will be looking, they will be wondering who this is. We agreed that we would only talk about the historical period and not his role from 2011 onwards. If we did do that, I think it would have put a target on him. But given the material we have now, which is contextual and historical, important nonetheless. I still think that he's safe, and that matters greatly to me.
Martin Juloff covers the Middle East for The Guardian. He's reported from the region since 2005. Martin, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
It's swan song for a lot of folks in Congress this week, but you wouldn't know it that the midterm elections even happened with the late night drama in D.C. Another spending bill cliffhanger, looming government shutdown avoided. To the great frustration of some, the trillion-dollar deal passed last night will be the last vote they cast, and that's the situation for outgoing Republican Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann. Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick asked Representative Bachmann about the biggest lessons she's learned from her time in office.
Money drives a lot of the decisions because people have to spend so much time raising money. I think that that's unfortunate. Also, the other thing is we are so busy here that members really don't get to know one another. And that's sad. Even people that sit on the same committee, they're in the same party, they can even be serving from the same state, and they don't get to know each other. And we can do so much more if we get to know each other and we actually sit down and talk about bills. But the way that it works here is that the leadership makes all the decisions and they jam the result down the throats of the members. And so it isn't a bottom-up process, it's a top-down process. I think it's terrible. I think it's disrespectful of the public. And I think we would all be a lot better off if we would do what we told the voters we were going to do. And I can say that. I have told the voters what I'm going to do. They know that I am a strong, principled conservative, and I've delivered on that promise. And I told them I was going to be a fighter. So I'm very grateful that I did what I did. Even though I've lost fights along the way, I suited up.
What was the best thing you experienced about Washington these eight years?
I don't mean politics.
I mean living in Washington, the city, the district.
Easy. What I've really loved is the fact that Washington, D.C., and Congress in particular, is a knowledge factory. It is unending knowledge, and I love knowledge and studying things. So that's what I've loved, too, is the unparalleled access to knowledge. Number two, you can't believe the people that you get to meet. Again, I'm Joe Normal, and I come to this city, and this week I spoke with President Obama. I spoke with Vice President Biden. That's just this week. And usually Joe Normal is a tourist. I just had to delay that for 8 years.
Well, congratulations on your retirement.
Thank you.
Ms. Bachmann.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
The special pain of homelessness in the winter months. Cleve Ray from Boston.
We don't feel like we're treated as human beings. We feel like we're treated more like livestock. And it's amazing that the city of Boston, as progressive as it is, and as much of a shining light as it is on the top of the hill, just kind of ignores human beings the way they ignore the homeless.
It's 58-year-old Cleve Ray talking about having to be moved en masse from a shelter in the Boston area because of safety concerns. He's right. Massachusetts has a progressive policy toward the homeless compared to the rest of the nation, but it also has a rising homeless population. Our next guest insists that a seeming impossible goal is within reach, however, the elimination of homelessness altogether. Philip Mangano was the nation's homeless czar under President George W. Bush. He's now president of the American Roundtable to Abolish Homelessness, based in Boston.
In Massachusetts, the number of families accessing homeless programs has gone up pretty substantially. I think there's undoubtedly a number of different reasons, and part of that is that notion of the right to shelter, that there is an oral tradition in Massachusetts around the notion of a right to shelter, and sometimes that has the effect of taking people out of doubled-up situations where they might be living with mom or an aunt and bringing them into the homeless system. So some of the incentives need to be fine-tuned, I think, and as a result of the lack of fine-tuning in that regard, more and more families, I would say, are literally hemorrhaging into homelessness in Massachusetts. And that's something I think that the new governor intends to tackle pretty early in his administration.
What do you say to the argument that, no, the homelessness rate is rising because people are crossing state lines to take advantage of the liberal programs in the state of Massachusetts?
Well, you know, in my work in Washington, I spent a lot of time in counties and cities all across our country. I never found one that didn't think that people were crossing the border, whether it was a city or a county or a state. It was always homeless people were coming from someplace else. They were never self-produced, so to speak. There is some truth to that, for sure. But in every set of data that's ever been done, every study that's ever been done, homeless people actually have a higher percentage of having been grown up in that community than the general population of the community. So there's some mythical elements to the notion that homeless people are coming from elsewhere to despoil our beautiful parks and beaches.
So how do you deal with some of that mythology? How do you get people who are in a position of responsibility to really face the reality of homelessness and hopefully have that reality help them make better decisions?
I think that speaks exactly to the advances that we've made in the last decade or 15 years on an issue that used to be based on conjecture and anecdote and good intentions. We've now advanced, I'd say evolved, to the place where we actually collect data and do research on the homeless population. What that research tells us is how expensive homeless people are in the community. We've learned that the random ricocheting of homeless people through very expensive health and law enforcement systems, or whether it's the emergency room of the hospital, that kind of data that demonstrates that the most expensive people in a community are in fact people who are living on the streets and ricocheting between shelters and all of those systems. That has not only initiated political will around the issue, but the fact that the costs are so great, that sustained political will over time. One of the things that we did in Washington is we asked communities to do research on how much it cost before a homeless person was housed, and then what were the costs after they were housed. What we learned was you could sustain people in homelessness for $35,000 to $150,000, or you could literally end their homelessness for $12,000 to $25,000. And that's what brought so many mayors, literally 1,000 mayors and county executives, to reduce and to attempt to end homelessness.
How do you think homelessness can be abolished, as you advocate? People think of it as a consequence of other things that happen, not an imposition like slavery.
Well, a lot of the work that we need to do around the country, here in Boston, across Massachusetts, and around the nation, is to look at the public policy around homelessness and bring remedy to that public policy, to upgrade the public policy, to be in tune with some of the innovative ideas that now dominate this issue. I think 15 years ago, you couldn't say this, but now we can. We know what to do, and we know how to do it.
Can you remind us how you underwent this personal transformation to move from doing something fundamentally different to really believing that this is solvable in your lifetime?
For me, in my own historical pursuits, I ran into the incredible relentlessness of the abolitionists. And as you know, one of their centers of location was here in Massachusetts. People like William Lloyd Garrison and John Andrew, who was actually the first Republican governor of Massachusetts, was a staunch abolitionist. They were attempting to bring remedy to a social disgrace that had been in our country for 200 years, that had been in human history for 6,000 years, and they believed that the time to bring it to an end had come. And even though they were ridiculed and laughed at, in fact, they were in tune with the common sense of the future. We would now not think about owning people. That if you went into a room of 5,000 people, whether in the North or the South in our country now, no one would think they should own anyone, that it was ridiculous. It was nonsense. Well, they brought the abolitionists of the 1840s, 50s, 60s, they brought the common sense of the future, our common sense that we now share, into their own time. Part of our work on the abolition of homelessness is that we understand not many years from now, our children, our grandchildren will wonder how we ever tolerated our neighbors being on the streets of our communities, on the streets of our nation.
Philip Mangano is president of the American Roundtable to Abolish Homelessness in Boston, Massachusetts. Philip, thanks so much.
Thank you so much, John, for having me.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity, introducing a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving. With brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program, performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
Superheroes, Bibles, and Hollywood, an irresistible combination to be sure. Ridley Scott's Exodus, Gods and Kings, which recounts the story of Moses in the Bible, a holy man who freed his people from slavery under the Egyptian pharaoh Ramses. I'm sure I don't have to tell you that. Ridley Scott cast Moses as white Christian Bale. The pharaoh Ramses is white. Tuya, Ramses' mother, is played by Sigourney Weaver. The Egyptian prince Seti is white. Joshua is white. And God, Ridley Scott cast a young white boy to play that part. Black characters, all the servants, assassins, and thieves, the Egyptian lower-class citizens. Well, with us is a very frustrated David Dennis Jr., writer and editor. David, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So how does this Exodus casting issue rank in terms of infuriating casting decisions in the annals of Hollywood? I mean, you've got Yul Brynner in The King and I. You've got Charlton Heston playing Moses, you know, a couple of generations ago. Put this in context, if you could.
Well, this one is particularly interesting in the fact that the ones you mentioned are sort of old. This one's happened in 2014. And that was my initial reaction when I saw it. I can't believe we're still whitewashing these characters, you know, in 2014. And on top of that, the fact that the people of color are, you know, slaves and assassins and thieves is adding another layer to it. This one is pretty up there in terms of being infuriating.
Now, you know, you and I both know Hollywood. I'm certain that, you know, there's a racial dimension to this. But, I mean, they pick stars on the basis of box office, right? I mean, Christian Bale is box office, right? I mean,
right. He is box office, but also, you know, the highest grossing actor of 2013 was a half black, half Samoan guy who used to wrestle named Dwayne Johnson. There are people of color that are stars. I mean, you know, it's not like, you know, Ridley Scott himself directed American Gangster, which is a black ensemble cast with, you know, Denzel Washington and Idris Elba, and grossed $266 million. It did well in the box office. So, you know, the idea that you can't have a movie with people of color that can bring box office stardom, you know, that just doesn't fly anymore.
Well, okay, so let's do our own casting here. Forget Ridley Scott and forget Christian Bale, and, you know, maybe people will see this, maybe they won't. I mean, the Bible's tricky territory, and Mel Gibson found out about that when he did The Passion, right?
Right.
All right, so who do we want to play Moses in your envisioning of this?
I mean, Denzel could do it. I mean, my idea of it doesn't even have to be, you know, a monolithic color of a cast. I mean,
Halle Berry could do Ramsey's mother.
Halle Berry could be in it. Idris Elba could have a part in there.
Patrick Stewart as Pharaoh.
Hey, knock yourself out. You can do all of those. Just the idea that, you know, it shouldn't just be an all white cast. The problem is, you know, somebody along the line should have said, hey, you know, these people don't look like what, you know, we've been taught that people in Egypt look like. And somebody should, you know, sit them down and say, you know, maybe we should rethink this cast. And maybe that happened, and maybe say, I don't care. I want to make the movie. You know, so I don't know exactly where his mindset was, but there should have been some sort of discussion about, you know, rethinking what was going on.
You know, who do you think is going to see this movie? People who, you know the book of Exodus?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, you'll have, I mean, Ridley Scott has a huge fan base. I'm sure people, you know, his fans will watch the movie. I have always been a big Ridley Scott fan before this happened. You know, I mean, you'll have people who are interested in religious stories. You have people who want to see Christian Bale as Moses. And you'll also have people who are out of spite towards the Boycott Exodus movie who are also going to see it. But, you know, from what I understand, the reviews aren't great on the movie. So, you know, who knows?
Yeah. Well, we'll see how this does at the box office. You know, as they say in Hollywood, any publicity is good. So I'm wondering if they're actually thrilled with this blowback.
Yeah, I mean, they might be. I mean, you know, sometimes these Bible stories are hard to market and hard to sell. And so there is, you know, a hashtag that at least has their movie's name in it that's been going on for months, you know, even if it has the word boycott in it. You know, they are getting some publicity, but I do get the impression that they were a little surprised by it, by the way the actors and Ridley Scott himself have reacted to the boycott movement hasn't been the most tactful. So I feel like they were a little taken aback by it.
And defensive.
Right, yeah, and very defensive. Ridley Scott just told, you know, people to get a life. So, and then Christian Bale said that, you know, he hopes that one day somebody will have a movie with the Moses of color, which is interesting that an actor would say, you know, maybe one day somebody will get this movie right, but in the meantime, go see mine.
All right, so David, thank you very much.
All right, thanks a lot.
David Dennis Jr. is a writer who shows us once again that writers have no power in Hollywood. As we mentioned, tomorrow we slip by an utterly pointless milestone in this century. Tomorrow is 12-13-14. Unless you are European and do calendar dates the proper way, in which case it's day first, 13, then month, 12, then year, 14. But forget all that. Stick with 12-13-14. It's more fun. The next consecutive integer sequence on the calendar is not for 89 years. On January 2nd, 2103. Just one of the moments I will miss, along with probably the most horrible devastation of global warming, that's all in the future, the Cubs winning the World Series, long in the future, or the day Afghanistan and Iraq become the 51st and 52nd states. I may live to see that, actually. But look closely at 12, 13, 14. In chemistry, the elements 12, 13, and 14 are magnesium, kind of explosive at room temperature, aluminum and silicon, kind of not. This makes me think of all kinds of lists. I mean, who wants to be 12th, 13th, or 14th of anything? Time has a list of the 100 most influential people of all time. 12, Charlie Darwin. 13, Elizabeth I, Queen of England. 14, Karl Marx. What does that say? Nothing. 12, 13, 14 on the richest people in the world list. Lillian Betancourt and family, whose billions come from face cream. Michael Bloomberg, whose media billions come from bond stats and face time. And Mark Zuckerberg. Of Facebook, 12, 13, and 14. And let's end here. Best-selling books, single volume of all time, and all we've really got as a source is Wikipedia, but then who cares, right? 12 is Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince, not the biggest Potter by a long shot. 13, I love this, Catcher in the Rye. Wild, huh? And 14, The Alchemist. I can hear you Alchemist fans screaming, "We got robbed!" But then, remember, in order to find the treasure, you have to follow the omens. Zila Acosta, you're getting married tomorrow. That's a good omen, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Very good omen. Did you have trouble booking a room, getting caterers?
It was difficult to book the space initially. And once I booked the space, they helped me get vendors. And without them, I don't know what I would have done because it was pretty tough.
12, 13, 14, is that something to tell your kids? Is that going to be good luck? What do you think?
I think it'll be good luck. Hopefully it's just a memorable date. My fiance and I don't actually have an anniversary for when we started dating. So hopefully this will be memorable enough for our both.
Yeah, well, that's pretty good. 12, 13, 14. Also joining us to think about sort of the mathematical implications of the sequence of integers is Victoria Jaggard, who's the online science editor for Smithsonian Magazine. Hi, Victoria.
Hello.
So in the world of sequences, consecutive integers is fairly low grade, right? As a sort of mover and shaker.
Yeah, it's just your straightforward 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. It's not gonna rock anybody's world, I'm pretty sure.
So, what sequence is coming up? Because we're out of consecutive integers here in this century. What sequence is coming up rock your world?
Well, one of the ones that I think people could get most excited about are the Fibonacci numbers. So, looking at August 13th in 2021.
And that Fibonacci sequence is the same sequence that determines the spirals in a shell, that sort of thing, right?
It's very, very close to the golden ratio when you start looking at growing sizes of tiles, for example, according to the sequence, and then you draw a spiral around it, and it looks incredibly close to that golden ratio that the Greeks so admired for properties to do with beauty.
Now, Zilli, you don't want to wait till 2021.
No, no, I think that might be a little too long.
All right. Other sequences.
Well, we can also look at prime numbers or the Mersenne primes, which are also incredibly exciting because primes are any number. It's a whole number greater than one that you can't divide by anything other than itself and one.
And what have we got coming up in the primes?
In the primes, we have 11, 13, 17.
That's nice.
Also not too far away. A Mersenne prime is any prime number less that is one less than a power of 2. So, for example, 2 to the third power gives you 8, right? 2 times 2 times 2. 8 minus 1 is 7. We know 7 is a prime number, so 7 is a Mersenne prime.
Now, could you just say, Victoria, just so I could hear it again, incredibly exciting?
Incredibly exciting.
Right. I don't know how exciting that is, but if that's incredibly exciting for you, I'm going with it. Totally. Finally, let's hear a little bit of music here. All right, so that is a musical realization of what sequence that actually I didn't hear anything about until last night. Victoria?
That's the Rakaman sequence. And this one can get a little bit complicated. The rules for getting this particular sequence can be a bit of a mouthful, let's say. But there is a rule behind it. There is a pattern to the madness.
And it's something like if you can't add, subtract, something like that. And,
yes,
and
exactly.
It goes by one, and sometimes the numbers go up, and sometimes the numbers go down. What are the next two Rakaman sequence numbers in the calendar?
You're going to be looking out for 7, 13, 20.
Okay.
Or 8, 25, 43.
All right. Well, all exciting mathematical things to look for in this century, and I thought we were done at 12, 13, 14. Victoria, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Victoria Jaggert is online science editor for Smithsonian Magazine. Zilli Acosta, any sort of weird kind of decorations on your cake to deal with the numbers?
No weird decorations. I have had some copycats. I know some people were trying to get married on 5-5-2015, which is not a special sequence that Victoria mentioned, but I think to the common man it does seem sequential.
But imagine how exciting it must have been. 12, 13, 14, 15. So
yeah.
December 13, 14, 15. I think people were getting ready to experience plague or something probably in the Renaissance.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Zilli Acosta, have a great wedding.
Thank you so much.
Zilli Acosta is getting married tomorrow on 12, 13, 14.
Shannon from Wallingford, Pennsylvania. I have two beautiful daughters and two numbers that stick out to me because of them. 316, my younger daughter, Brady, now a U.S. Army soldier, went to a Baptist youth group as a kid, and she used to say that John 316 was her favorite verse. The second number is 1210. It's my daughter Shauna's birthday.
I'm Adam from San Jose. My dozens of hours playing Minecraft means that multiples of 8 and powers of 2 will always appeal to me as round. Or should that be square numbers?
I love this. I just totally love this. You and your numbers. You know how to reach is 877. 8 might take. Those are numbers. What do they mean? They're very meaningful. Fort Lauderdale, Florida. 19 stands out for me. I'm a fan of Stephen King, and the number 19 is important in several of its books. It's also a prime, but not a Mersenne prime. From Haddonfield, New Jersey. 8888 stands out for me personally. I started my job on that date, worked there for 20 years. Great job and my lucky day. Lucky 8, unlucky 0.
Hello, my name is Justin. I'm calling from Eugene, Oregon. The numbers that always stand out to me are the zeros I see in my checking account day after day because I haven't quite figured out how to be successful in this life.
Justin, oh man, come on, have a nice weekend. We got to get you on the show one of these days. From Seattle, Washington, my number has always been 42 because it's the answer to life, the universe, and everything. The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
The answer to the ultimate question of life, the universe, and everything is 42.
Two?
No.
Yes, yes, I thought it over quite thoroughly.
No. It's 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's the answer to everything. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great 12-13-14 and 12-14-14. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
PRI, Public Radio International.